Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes. Got a very exciting show for you today. Where else can you get an Army guy and a Navy guy in the same room and have them be civil to each other? No, I think that happens a lot. Even though Navy has dominated the football series of late, as I'm sure Bob Nagel will remind Earl Watson today. Yes, I have two World War II veterans in studio this afternoon. Earl the Pearl Watson is here to talk about Johnny Grant a little bit later on. And before we get to you, Earl, tell us really quickly when you first met Johnny Grant. And for those of our listeners who don't know who Johnny Grant is, just give us a brief synopsis of that.
Well, I was a doorman at the number one hotel in Hollywood called the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel, where all the movie stars and celebrities and everything. Ronald Reagan got me the job as a doorman at the hotel, and I was rated the best doorman in the world because I treated people very, very nice. Anyway, Johnny pulled up in a little kind of old car, and I could tell when he pulled up that he didn't have much money. And I talked to him nice, and with his personality, I discovered that he was just a real nice person. And he said, "Hey, doorman," he said, "I'm going to be honest with you." He said, "I'm invited in here to a luncheon," and he said, "I don't know where I can park. I don't want to get a ticket parking on the street." And the parking was 25 cents. And he couldn't park in the lot. I said, "Johnny," I said, you leave your car right here. And from now on, whenever you're in this area, you leave your car there, and I'll take care of it. You don't have to worry about it whenever you're around here. And so we started a friendship then, and then he would drive by the hotel and say, "Are there any celebrities in the hotel?" And he had a radio show. He was one of the top disc jockeys in Hollywood. And he'd come by, and I'd tell him different friends of his was staying at the hotel, and I introduced him to W.D. Griffith, the guy when he first came by that started the movie industry, the moving pictures. And I introduced him to him in the lobby of the hotel, and introduced him to Elvis and Colonel Parker and Eddie Arnold. And
there's a lot of stories here that we're going to get to, that's for sure. And the reason that we have Earl here today to talk about Johnny Grant is Johnny Grant, who was a World War II veteran, served in the Army Air Corps in the war, then had a radio show that talked about servicemen, did some advance work for Glenn Miller and his troop, and then, of course, was the honorary mayor of Hollywood for years and years. Johnny passed away this past week, so to honor his legacy, we have Earl on today, and we'll get to those stories a little later in the show. But Earl, thanks for being here to do that.
Thank you.
For now, let's move on to Bob Nagel, and I'll tell you, two guys in the studio today, if in 50-something years I can consider myself to have as much vim and vigor and joie de vivre as the two of you have, I think I'll be in good shape. Because, Bob, you're 89 years old, and I understand you've been making a regular habit of scoring under your age on the golf course?
It's become easy.
Just wait till you get 100.
I'll wait.
He will wait. Now, Earl is the Army guy. Bob's the Navy guy. And, Bob, tell us a little bit to start off. Before you ever got on the helm of a PT boat, how did you first end up in the Navy? What was going through your mind when you decided to suit up in Navy blue?
I think it was in everybody's mind at the time. Draft was in full effect, too. My older brother had gone in and in the Navy, and he advised me. He said they're looking for communication officers, and so he actually gave me a path to get in very quick without becoming a deck officer volunteer, which would be a DVS and would require training for 6 months in Chicago or someplace for become an officer, become an ensign. I went down to the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and I went into the communication officer's office and said, "I want to join the Navy." He took me, made me a CVS, because now he had control over me. He could keep me in the Navy Yard. Other DVSs who had just enlisted in the Navy had gone to work in the communications because they had to bring in officers. As soon as the war started, every communication was in code, and only officers could be allowed to handle it, break it down, or deliver it. Many of the officers who were DVS stayed in the communications until a ship was ready in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and then they'd pull them away from them. So he had me there for about a year. After that year, I was ready for sea anyway. I wanted to get out of the, get to the work.
See some action, I guess. But first they gave you a very difficult assignment that I know is really hard for you to swallow in Cape May, New Jersey.
Well, yes, the 4th Naval District had moved its headquarters out of Philadelphia down to Cape May, New Jersey, which was a smart move. It was nicer down there, and so was the summers. And I was in the communications office. I was a communication officer down there. And one evening, 11 waves arrived, and I had to greet them and schedule them for the next morning they had arrived. It's just, they were the first class that was graduated from Smith College. And suddenly I was not only concerned about the Navy, but I have 11 waves under my command.
Well, and you need to protect these young ladies from these Navy guys who are going to try to find a wife among them, right?
I did that very well, yes. I found one of them who changed her name to mine.
So without the Navy, you wouldn't have met your wife in Cape May.
That's true.
Way back when. And so that was, I guess, the first big thrill of your time in the Navy. Before long, though, they said, we think you could handle a PT boat. I'm sure they said it just like that.
I had a lot of experience in boats. I knew how to paddle a canoe, and I could row a boat. And with that background, they thought I was qualified to sail a 80-foot torpedo boat with 12-cylinder engines.
Mm-hmm.
They were giant engines. And, I did it. They sent me to school first to learn quite a bit about it.
You talk about those Packard engines, three Packard 12s on that boat. I bet when you got back on dry land, you wished you could find a Packard that could do what your boat could do.
Pulled up alongside a car the other day. It was a beautiful-looking car. And I looked at it on the front, and it said V12 on it. I just couldn't imagine. We now have automobiles running out there with 12 cylinders.
That's a throwback for sure. Especially in the day and age of the environmental restrictions on cars that we have.
It's a brand new car.
I'll have to find that. I'll check that out. Let's go back in time again to the first time that you ended up as the captain of a PT boat. Initially, you thought you were going to be in the South Pacific, didn't you?
Yes. In fact, I was assigned to a squadron that was fitting out in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Which was nice, too, because it kept me in New York City for a while longer while my mother and father were living in the city. And when our boats were delivered from Bayonne, New Jersey, the Elko Boat Works, we made these fast ships, they were painted green, and we were scheduled to go down to Miami for shakedown, from there down to the Panama Canal Zone and ship out to the South Pacific. But after waiting, our shakedown took about 2 weeks, and we notified the Sinclair Commander Atlantic Fleet that we were ready for sea, but he didn't pay much attention to us. He made us stay down in Miami for
Stuck in Miami for a month, I guess.
Well,
huh?
In January, too.
You're just pulling the tough assignments left and right.
It got better. When we finally received our orders, we were told to return to New York. So this time, as soon as we arrived in New York, they painted us blue. Immediately then sent us down to Norfolk to be on tankers, where they would lift the PTs, about six of us, on the deck of a tanker. And we joined a convoy on its route to the Mediterranean.
And that's where you would finally see some significant action. You heard Bob talk about being from New York City. I have to tip my cap to you again. When I scheduled Bob for the show today, I wasn't thinking that the New York football Giants would be on TV taking on the Dallas Cowboys. So I really appreciate you being with us while that's going on. And by the way, the Giants lead the Cowboys 21-17 with under 12 minutes to go.
So thank you for the good news.
They're in good shape. We won't get into Frank Gifford and Sam Huff and all the great old-time Giants today. We'll stick to the military stories. Right now, we have to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll find out what Bob Nagel encountered in the Mediterranean and why he's pretty thankful that he's here today to talk about all of his experiences during World War II. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Only on the Central Valley's Big One. News Talk 580 KMJ. Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A little bit later in the show, we will talk about the late, great Johnny Grant, a World War II veteran and a friend of veterans all over the world. He did so many USO shows, a record-setting number of USO shows over the years. We'll talk to his good friend, Earl Watson, more about that later. For now, we continue with Bob Nagel, who is 89 now, but at age 23, the Navy decided to give him the helm of a PT boat. And it's real encouraging, Bob, as you're heading over to the Mediterranean, when you get an understanding of why they needed PT boats over there in the Mediterranean. It was that the destroyers were a little too valuable.
The Admiral Hewitt, who was in charge of the 8th Fleet, had destroyers on hand, but the waters were heavily mined along the coastal areas, and that's where the Germans were trafficking with trying to supply the two armies. They had an army fighting against our army in Italy and another army on the in France, and they were shipping supplies out of Genoa harbor, and they hugged the coastline, and then outside the coastline, actually wherever it was less than 100 feet deep, why it was heavily mined. We did lose four boats of the squadrons to mines, and if they had been destroyers, it would have been considerably heavier damage and loss of life and the larger ships of the Navy.
And of course, there's a famous movie that kind of illustrates this point. They were expendable. You were expendable as a PT boat. They could afford to lose you more so than a destroyer. And, of course, that was that John Wayne movie back in 1945 that is still a fun one to watch if you have some time and want to go look at it. I know Bob's seen it a time or two. And it was fun for me to watch that movie and get a taste for some of the kinds of things that you experienced in the Mediterranean in World War II. And you weren't in the movies, but you were in Yank Magazine.
I didn't realize that until I was on my way back to the States. The first I'd been over for about a year, and our squadron was decommissioned. I was to take four boats back to the States, and as I sailed into Iran Harbor, I had a friend there who said, "Did you see the Yank magazine?" "No," and he said, "The cover picture had a picture of my gunner," and then inside was a story written by one of the editors of Yank magazine, who had gone out on a patrol with us one night. And while on board the boat, he kept talking to the crew, and he picked up a few stories, that experiences we had, and he wrote in a very, it was an unusual.
There's some very complimentary quotes in there from the members of your crew. Guys saying that you were a cool guy, and it took a lot of nerve to be able to keep your hand off the throttle.
Yes, that's true. When I look back, I realize I never really appreciated or knew what they did think of me as their skipper. And they were a great crew. I admired every one of them. Been in touch with them recently. And in fact, I sent them the copy of our last...
We did a TV story, Stories of Service, on Channel 47 with Bob, and they've all seen that now.
They've seen it, and I've received letters from their wives, and in several cases, they were so pleased to get it because it was near their end, and it brought a few smiles on their face.
And if you ever get a chance to see that that issue of Yank Magazine, which is featured in the TV story, too, which you can still see online at CBS47.tv, you'll see that they have a picture of the boat, the PT-559, which is ironic now that you live in this area code. And along the bridge, six swastikas are on there. What do those six swastikas represent?
Well, we would go out on... the missions we'd go on were... consisted of three PT boats, and we were to patrol the coast, southern coast of France and the coast of Italy, trying to locate the enemy shipping. We were very fortunate in having radar on our boats because it enabled us to find them and then get into position to be able to release our torpedoes in and trying to destroy as much of the shipping as we could. On my first patrol was a very unusual success. We were three boats, and we were patrolling from the southern coast of France. And we picked up radar blips on two ships that were at extremely fast speed. We clocked them for a while and found they were running at about 28 knots. And so we maneuvered in position. This is the middle of the night, and there was a quarter moon of rising off in the east, from the east. And as we got within about 1,500 yards of those ships, I could see the silhouette of the ships from the background of the moon. And my boat was first in line, so I was I assigned the first ship. Second ship was to hold his torpedoes in case we missed and we'd have some defense. The third boat took the second ship. They turned out to be small destroyers, and I was able to put the pinpoint of my direction finder. I had a little gadget on there that I entered the speed of the ship and the course of the ship, and that gave me a lead for to drop my torpedoes. I dropped one of them right at the bow, and the next one, I figured that would slow them down a little if it hit them, and the next one right in the midships. And within the time allowed, it was about 1 minute before they arrived at, no, a little longer than that, but we had them clocked. That lead ship just disintegrated. It blew up as if it was the 4th of July celebration. We saw flares and everything going sky high, and it was completely destroyed. And seconds later, there was a flash on the stern of the second ship. And we found out later that we had sunk both of those stripped ships. They were the German ships called the TA-26 and the TA-30, which were the equivalent of our small destroyers.
Not bad for the first night out.
It was quite an eventful night, yes. And on our way back, dawn was coming up. And we also had picked up on radar the blip of an airplane nearby, so we radioed in that we had what we had done and that we might need some cover if that plane was out looking for us. And the base where the planes left was in the northern part of Corsica, and as it got lighter in the day, we saw the planes coming in towards us, and both planes, they were British Beauforts, I think. They did a barrel roll over our ships, which was a salute to us.
Salute for getting those two ships the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And those became two of the swastikas on your ship, because you got one for each ship that you could confirm that you sank.
Well, another was quite an interesting one, and then my radar picked up a small boat in front of a much larger one. Well, as we approached it, it's another night on patrol.
Was it cold out that you're standing on the deck? Is this cold? Is it windy? What were the elements?
No, the time of the year was April, May, June, so I wasn't. In fact, I just wore a jacket. And,
and when you say you send your torpedoes, you don't press a button. This takes teamwork. You have to call out which torpedo, and someone else has to pull a lever and actually get it in the water, right?
The original PT boats had tubes on them, and you might have seen in the John Wayne movie. And with compressed air, they were able to force a torpedo out of the tube into the water and on its way. Even going out of the tube, it was triggered to start the propellers going on the torpedo. But we've devised a plan where we put a rack on the four racks replaced four tubes. Took about 8,000 pounds off the deck of the torpedo and gave us more speed and maneuverability,
which you would need.
Yeah, often we needed it. But that rack had two dogs on it holding up the torpedo, and I would call back to the torpedo man, fire one, and he would have to pull a trip wire, and to start the propellers. He started the torpedo on deck himself, then pulled the lever, which dropped the torpedo in the water. And he was so rapid at it that I never lost my need for changing my lead on the ship that I was firing at. That was three of the ships. what one was I headed into?
Well, yeah, we talked about that first night. You had the two, and then you had a situation where you're out with two British boats, I believe, in September of 44, and ran into a German supply convoy.
Yeah, we were three boats. Two British boats would follow my boat because we had the radar, and we would have that way we would have 2-4-6 torpedoes to be able to fire into any of the convoys. As we were approaching this one convoy that we picked up, it was a considerable size, and we were all ready in ready for action in torpedoes rather than guns. But my radar room kept calling up, advising that there was a target astern of us approaching us very rapidly. He was clocking him. He kept coming closer and wasn't. And I was more interested in getting sights on the convoy ahead of me. But we took my gunner, Gillette, who was right on the 50 caliber right near the bridge, called to me, "Mr. Nagel, look." I had him there because he had the best eyes on the boat, but I could see it too. I was able to, it was I could see a shape of a destroyer. It was running straight at us as if that was its mission, to get it there and to ram us if they could, or just get it amongst us. And so I told the helmsman, I was right next to LaBelle, my quartermaster, hard right rudder, and the boat turned so that I was just able now to allow, I could see the whole outline of this sleek, beautiful looking destroyer.
That wanted to kill you.
Oh, I didn't have any fear of him at the moment. I just wanted to do something quickly and move out. And so I was able to line my boat up. I think I allowed only about 25 yards ahead of his bow. And even with that, it didn't hit him until the stern. And that was a tremendous flash. Our torpedoes had about 800 pounds of TNT in, and that's what exploded when it hit it. I was concerned that we were so close to him that the torpedo may not
arm.
Yeah. But it had, and it was quite dramatic. We could see the tail gun, which was about 3-inch 50 or larger, just lifted right off the deck of the destroyer, and there was the pointer or the loader. I could see him rising up. The fact that I could see them shows you how close we were.
You saw him and the gun flying up in the air.
Yeah, both of us, my quartermaster, we spoke of it later. I moved. I expected him to just before the torpedoes hit. I forgot about this. Their gunner saw the track of my torpedo going through the water towards the destroyer.
Because it bubbles up and there's a little light there too, right?
It's fluorescent because the torpedoes were running only at 2 feet deep, so it throws up quite a churn. And yes, it's fluorescent in the water, and the gunner, he knew what he was doing. He's just fired straight down the track of the torpedo. And I had turned to the port side, and it had allowed me to get just out of the way of my track and the shells that were coming down in the water. I could hear them go plap, plap, plap right across the water, and look, saw them just missing stern. But by going to the left, those two British boats didn't know what was happening. They didn't know that I hadn't been in touch with them. They didn't have the radar to know. But if I turned to the right, which would be the normalcy to get away from there, the ship's going, your enemy's going one way, you want to be going the other way. If I'd gone that way, that gunner, there were two of them actually that were firing 20 millimeters down, would have cut me in half and probably cut them in half too. But we got away, and I kept waiting for star shells. That's what the Germans used. They could light up the whole area, and then suddenly we had no longer the cover of darkness, and you put your hand on the throttle then and tried to get it. But without the star shells, I stayed idling until I was able to get a bow of them quite a bit and then turn south to get around where he wouldn't expect me to be, thinking I'd be on his left side. But he... only stayed afloat for about 5 or 10 minutes longer. We saw them disappear on our radar. Yeah, that's one of them. Huh?
And that, well, one thing you just said there, the normal thing would have been to go to the right. Had you gone to the right, your boat would have been a goner, and maybe the others too. What made you go to the left? If that's not what you were supposed to do, why in that situation did you?
Well, there were two other decisions that I had to make, but I didn't have time to think of them. And I wonder how I knew immediately to. One was to fire two torpedoes. I had to. If one had missed, I'd need the other one. But if I'd taken the time to fire the second one, that gunner would have been, we were that close, he still, that way he would have cut right down the bow to stern of my boat.
So that's one decision.
That's two. Yeah. The fact that I turned.
Well, in the turn. So there's two things that were crucial to your survival.
And the third one, I guess, was I kept my hand off the throttle. Because then they would have seen the wake of my boat and known I was there. Every gunner on that torpedo boat was at the guns, ready to shoot us up if they could see us. Why he didn't put star shells up, that's maybe another blessing.
Somebody was looking out for you, yes. I guess.
I can only attribute it to divine guidance.
Amen. Well, we need to get another commercial break in. When we come back, we'll wrap things up with Bob Nagel. We'll talk to Earl Watson about the late, great Johnny Grant. This is Hometown Heroes this afternoon, once again on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I know I say this every week, but the time goes by so quickly when you're hearing some of these incredible stories from gentlemen that served our country during World War II. We have two of them in the studio this afternoon. Earl Watson's going to talk in just a few minutes about Johnny Grant. We continue with Bob Nagel now. And I want to also tell you that next week we have a very interesting show. You know, a week from tomorrow we'll have the Run for the Dream track meet in the Save Mart Center, a fantastic event that Bob Fraley has put together. And the man who built the track that they're going to use, a $1 million track which was donated, the history of that track goes all the way back to World War II, why that man was in a position to build that track for Fresno State. And that man, Fred Arnold, will join us next week on Hometown Heroes, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to a little more from Bob Nagel here, and let me tell you that if you were to dig through all Bob's closets, somewhere in there he has buried some pretty impressive decorations, like a Distinguished Service Cross from the British government. He mentioned you heard him talk about serving with British boats as well. He also received the Croix de Guerre from the French and the Silver Star from the U.S. Navy. And on that citation, a little quote from there that I think kind of encapsulates Bob as a serviceman, as a sailor. The quote there was, "Exceptional ability, aggressive leadership, and outstanding devotion to duty. What more could you ask from?" And that's what Bob displayed in the Navy's words. Now, Bob, I know at one point you got to actually come back to the States, and after that you actually went back to the Mediterranean. You didn't get enough the first time, so you went back to the Mediterranean, and you had more adventures.
You know, this time we weren't working with the British Navy. The squadrons had been turned over to the French admiral in the Navy, and the base was a little more appreciated. We were about 5 miles from Cannes on the Riviera. But
another tough assignment. But the Moss boats weren't exactly hospitable to you.
No, they still maintained quite an armada of these fast torpedo boats. And in fact, the week before I arrived over there, one of them had torpedoed the French destroyer, the Trombe. So during the first week when I arrived back over in the Mediterranean, I was given the mission of taking two PT boats out. They were different squadrons, Squadron 22, and I was no longer on my 559, but I was sailing on the 227. And with one other boat, we did pick up a target, a very fast-moving target that night. And I approached him. I just brought the two boats directly in line with him. I kept in line. He was going at close to 30 knots, which assured me it was a Moss boat. That's the German-Italian equivalent of a torpedo boat. And I was actually able to bring the two PTs so that we passed this Moss boat no more than 25 yards away from him. And we opened fire and got return fire immediately. They neither knew, could hear us in the distance, but they were as well aware of us as we were of them, of it, rather, with just one boat. But I was firing two 40 millimeters, two 20 millimeters, and four 50 caliber machine guns at this craft, 70 feet long, no more than 30 yards abeam of us. He was returning fire, and of course we passed in a matter of seconds, but there was a lot of flak that went between our two boats. And the amazing thing, not one shot was hit, not one hit was made on either boat. Well, I turned to starboard, and my other boat had made a turn to the left. Normal procedure was both boats turn in the same direction, should have, because now I couldn't tell whether I was looking behind a friendly or the enemy boat.
That's not good.
But they were firing at each other from about 100 yards apart, just bean to bean, but nothing was just constantly, and the war was getting too close to the end. I called them to break off, and we'll follow him in. He was racing into his port. And so the other boat broke off, came in back, beam of me, and now I was right behind that Moss boat, and the whole Mediterranean seemed to explode in front of me. He's pretty smart. He dropped the depth charge right in front of me, and my boat shook a little, and we got wet from it, but it exploded too fast. A little longer, he would have been...
you would have been sky high.
He would have been in charge. Yes, but... then I was able to running at a high speed right behind him. Got my bow gunner, 20 millimeter, to keep firing into his wake. And he stopped dead in the water, and we came up alongside. They'd rafted off somewhere, the crew. And we had received just that day messages through the Navy that not to board enemy E-boats or crafts, because they had booby-trapped them. And and so I blew the bow off of this Moss boat with my 40 millimeter, figuring they could raft it but it was certainly out of action for the rest of the war. But that was the last action I had. And
going out with a bang. That was certainly memorable, and again, somebody was looking out for you, apparently, with all those bullets flying and nobody getting hit. Well, Bob, thanks so much for being here. Thank you for your service to our country, and thanks for giving me something to shoot for when I'm 89. If I can ever shoot your age, even when I'm 31, I'll be very happy.
Thank you, Paul.
Good luck on the golf course. Now let's talk to Earl Watson. We bring him back in, and Earl is a veteran. He was at the Battle of the Bulge. He was all over Europe in the couple of years at the tail end of World War II that he spent in the service, but he also has a long association with Hollywood, and you got to know Johnny Grant, as you told us earlier on in the show. Johnny had been in the service and obviously loved other servicemen and spent really the rest of his life dedicating a lot of his time to the USO and to making sure that our troops were entertained. And I'm sure just being a friend and an acquaintance of his, that's probably one of the things you admired most about him.
Right. Well, I don't know of anybody in this country that has honored the soldiers from the different wars as much as Johnny Grant did. Johnny Grant entertained the very first troop and then show. He emceed the show. He put the show together. He was the background of the show. He put the movie stars on the show. And he started out on locally going to different army camps in the United States and entertaining the troops, and then he entertained the troops over 50 or 60 times around the world in different places. And the thing that got me was that he was the very first person to entertain and the last. A couple of weeks ago, he was just over Guantanamo Bay, whatever you call it. He was there, and I called him up before he went there, and I told him, I said, Johnny, I said, I'm kind of concerned about you because you have a very bad back. You've been in a hospital with a fractured back, and they can't operate on this, they couldn't operate on his back. And I said, I'll go along with you and roll you in the wheelchair and look out for you and make sure everything is okay. He says, Earl, the Army's taking care of everything. They're flying me first class. And he said, I won't have to worry about nothing. He said, I'll be able to make it. He was supposed to come up here to be in the parade with us.
I remember that. Yeah,
in, here in Fresno. And I wrote he wrote me a beautiful letter. I got a copy of it where he was going to appear in the parade and everything. And anyway, he made it all right. So I called him back last Tuesday. And I didn't expect to talk to him. I wanted to talk to his secretary because I have his private number. And I wanted to find out his secretary how he's doing since he got back. And he answered the phone. I was surprised that he answered the phone. And I said, Johnny, I was just concerned about how you're doing, how you're feeling. And I said, he said, and how was the trip? He said, Earl, it was so wonderful. I'd love to go back again. And he said, as a matter of fact, I'm planning to go back again. But he said, I got a problem with my shoulder. And he says, I have a terrible pain of arthritis in my left shoulder. And I believe that that was a heart pain that he was having, because I've never heard him complain of arthritis before, or even a shoulder pain. Mm. And right after that, he must have passed away, because the next day at 7 o'clock in the evening, I guess his secretary, I haven't been able to get in touch with her. She's home ill. They couldn't get in touch with her. So they sent the ambulance and the police department over to his penthouse at the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood. And they got there, and he was found dead. But this guy entertained. I gave him a new nickname. They call him the mayor of Hollywood.
Right.
I called him the mayor of the United States.
Mm.
What a human being.
And a lot of people think, you know, that people just know him from the Hollywood side. Maybe they saw him in White Christmas, or
right.
They see him when they do the Walk of Fame and all these stars are down there, because he's at every one of those. He's been the honorary
right.
of mayor of Hollywood since 1980. But obviously you saw the side of him.
Yeah.
Love the men and women who are out there on the
right.
front lines, because once upon a time he was in the service too. Do you think that's what it was that made him have that kind of passion for it? Was it just the fact that he had walked in those shoes? Or what do you think it was about him that made that such an important part of his life?
Well, he was a lot like me. He was a hero worshiper. He liked Hero because he got along with all the movie stars and all the celebrities and everything. And his 84th party that he had there at the Roosevelt, my wife and I at Melbourne were his guests. The thing is, he said, I'm only going to honor two people. And Mickey Rooney was because I wanted to come to Hollywood, and I wanted to be like Mickey Rooney. He said, so I came to Hollywood. And he said, the person I'm ironing is my best friend for 62 years. He had me to stand up, and he ironed me as his best friend. And right afterwards, everybody gave me a standing ovation, and he had two tables there full of military personnel, generals, and from all walks of the Navy, the Navy, the Marines, and everything. And I was so impressed when all of them came over and honored me, for what I did in the war. Yeah, I have a hard time talking about the war without having tears, because I had a hard time for 3 years in the war. It's a miracle I lost 1,800 men in my regiment. Not one is left. 1,800 men. So I'm a big fan of the war. I can't even go to the VA. I can't go around those soldiers in the VA. It was a horror story.
I read those pictures all the time.
You do, huh?
There are a lot of difficult moments, I know, and
right.
I know that you're thankful to be here. I know someone was looking out for
That's
you.
That's right.
We'll get in our last commercial break here while we have the chance. We'll come back more with Earl Watson talking about Johnny Grant. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes this Sunday. Again, next week, we'll talk a little bit about the story behind the story of the Run for the Dream meet, which is coming up a week from tomorrow. Next week, we'll have the man who has built that indoor track, a $1 million track that Fresno State was able to use for years and years, and why the story of that track goes all the way back to World War II. We've heard from Bob Nagel today about his service as a torpedo boat skipper in the Mediterranean during the war, and we continue now with Earl Watson. And if you caught the program a couple weeks ago, we had Bill D. Zietzel, the fine publisher of Veterans Magazine, which is headquartered right here in the Central Valley. And that September issue, if you happen to come across it, has a picture of a charming-looking doorman at the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel. That was Earl Watson. And inside that article, you see pictures of Earl with Elvis Presley, with Muhammad Ali, and several other Hollywood and sports stars. And another Hollywood star who he was very good friends with was Johnny Grant, passed away this past week after a lifetime of honoring the men and women in uniform. Is there any one story about Johnny and something he did that maybe exemplifies the kind of guy he was that you like to tell? I know you like to tell stories. Do you have a favorite Johnny Grant story, Earl?
One of my favorite Johnny Grant story was that Johnny found out that Elvis was coming to Hollywood, and he wanted to meet Elvis, and meet Elvis's managers, Colonel Parker and Tom Diskin. And I set it up for him to meet him and everything, and Elvis gave Johnny a couple of his little records. They weren't CDs, you know, the little small records.
45s?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Gave him a couple of them, and Johnny took them and put them in the back seat of his car in the summertime and drove around. He got ready to play them. They were warped, and he couldn't play them, and he had to come back over and said, Earl, can you get me a couple more, because I damaged those particular records by putting them in the back seat of the car, and I had to have the colonel to send him some more records. But Johnny just, boy, he was Hollywood, man. That guy is really something. I guess everybody knows that they're going to put his ashes under the Hollywood sign. That's a big story. Under the Hollywood sign up in the Hollywood Hills,
mm-hmm.
at Zion Hollywood. And if you call his private number right now, he would say, please leave a message and have a beautiful Hollywood day. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really quite a deal. And there's just so many things about him. And boy, that people would pull up, celebrities would pull up in front of the hotel and said, Earl, I'm a friend of Johnny Grant. He told me that you let me park here, or you help me do this, or whatever, you know. And we were just in a circle of good friends. And Gene Autry retired him. As a matter of fact, this is really something. Gene Autry offered me the job that he gave to Johnny Grant. He gave Johnny Grant a job with a lifetime salary. I won't mention the salary, but it's pretty big, with an office, a KMPC radio,
right,
and a KTLA TV, and a secretary at the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, and a penthouse for a lifetime at the Roosevelt Hotel with a secretary. And his secretary's name is Jackie. And all expenses paid. So he did very well financially, and Gene Autry was quite a guy. And in our bar at the hotel, Gene Autry would be there, and Roy Rogers, and John Wayne, and a lot of the different movie stars would come in there, Sinatra,
and it sounds like to me that Johnny Grant felt as much respect and maybe more admiration for the men and women in uniform who he went to entertain so often as he did for those big guys that people were fawning over all the time.
It was rare for a person to show that much concern for soldiers and men in uniform like he did. And even at his birthday party, and having two tables there full of them, generals and everything, they just liked them. And, of course, I mentioned before that I said we should call him the mayor of the United States, because nobody should have that title than him, and he should be remembered for a long time. And, you know, Hollywood is hard to stay there as the mayor, because all the different fashions of people try to take over the power of mayor and to run Hollywood and everything else. And he started the Hollywood Parade. He honored my family on the float of the Hollywood Parade. And he started a lot of things there, and they named a street after him, going right in to the Kodak Theater, where they have the Academy Awards after Johnny.
Real quick, we've got less than 2 minutes left in the show, but I'm wondering if Johnny, since you both did serve during World War II, did he ever share with you any of his experiences during the war? Were there meaningful things that he liked to talk about, or did he kind of keep that private?
Well, he was writing a book about his life during the war and his life in Hollywood and everything else, and he told me that the author that he was working with put stuff in the book that wasn't true and that he didn't know anything about, so he couldn't do it. But he kept telling me that he was going to do a book, and he wanted me to do a chapter of his book. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote out I did an audio tape for the chapter of the book, mm-hmm. and he never got it. He never got around to it. He said he wasn't ready for it, and maybe it's just something he didn't want. But I would like to mention there's a brand new museum in Hollywood near Hollywood, Hollywood Boulevard and Highland Avenue, 4 stories, Max Factor building.
Right.
And they got a huge room of all the pictures of Johnny Grant and all the war pictures and everything. It's really amazing. And they asked me to come down there and give them. I gave them 150 pictures to put in of
wow.
celebrities that I knew right. and the Knickerbocker Hotel. And they were going to put my pictures in the next few weeks in front of his display.
Well, I'll make sure I get down and visit that.
Right.
I'm in Southern California.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners will, too. Well, we're running out of time on the program today. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Bob Nagel and Earl Watson, for being here today. Earl, I know that Johnny would be very pleased that you were here to talk about him and tell everyone else who didn't know him the kind of person and the kind of patriot that he was, with all that esteem and respect for our veterans. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. We'll be back again next week with the story of Fred Arnold and that $1 million track at the Save Mart Center. Have a good Sunday afternoon. News Talk 580 KMJ.